Good morning. Welcome to the presentation on the greatness of being tested. Who loves being tested by their spouse, their children, their mother-in-law, the father-in-law? I'm going to start off with the following question. Can an athlete compete in the Olympics if he trained for 4 years without a coach? And if he does, what are his chances? Why is that? Why does an Olympic athlete need a coach? You know, when you study the psychology of sports, it's fascinating to read the research that has been done and the insights that have been found in the relationship between a coach and an athlete. It has been known to happen many a time that the athlete actually falls into the trap of thinking that a coach hates him. You know why? Because the coach is pushing him and pushing him to find out what's his maximum. So for example, if he's doing the high jump, every time he makes the jump, what does the coach do? He elevates the bar another millimeter, not more. So once he clears that height, he then elevates it yet another millimeter. Is it possible for the athlete to turn around and say, wait a minute, you're designing this, so eventually I'm going to fail? Now, it's also been known that not all athletes have PhDs and have come from the best colleges, at least in England I remember it being that way. So sometimes they really could fall into this trap. The question I want to ask ourselves is, let's take this model of an athlete being tested and analyze it for a few moments and look at the parallel in our own lives. When an athlete is training, we know that the end result is what we're really looking for. How well he's going to do in the final race. But what determines that result? What is the most important factor that determines that result? Confidence that he has the ability to succeed.
His attitude.
His attitude. That all those factors will definitely count. Stamina. Major factors. What's the one factor that without that, nothing's going to happen? Belief, attitude, stamina,
motivation,
self-confidence,
skills,
getting really warm,
belief,
training. See, if a person wants to get a gold medal in the righteous Olympics, the only way he's going to get there, yes, self-confidence, yes, I believe it's possible, others have, I can too, yes, I need to be motivated. Yes, I need stamina, that even when I fall, I'm going to pick myself up again and try again and again and again. But ultimately, I need a lot of exercises, training, practice. Hergel, in Hebrew, chinuch. Chinuch actually, although it translates as Jewish education, chinuch means training. That's what Maimonides tells us. That training our children to be prepared for adulthood. That's the race they're entering. They enter into the race of adulthood. I never forget when I was a teenager, I went to an unusual school and we were permitted to take off a lot of time. So I spent about 4 or 5 hours a day playing soccer. I was really into soccer. That was my favorite sport, still is today. And there was a time when I entered trials, about 700 candidates for first division soccer, and I got into the last 15. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're training for a first division team, I don't know how it goes in America, but about one third of the training is exercises, not just push-ups and swimming, and just exercises, not necessarily related to the soccer game. In fact, if you just came in totally unknowing what's going on, you would not know that this is preparing for a game of soccer. Another third of your training, essentially, is devoted to power moves, strategies, passing the ball, kicking the ball into the net or into the corner of the net. If you're a goalie, you have to be able to dive in different directions, so the ball would be thrown or kicked in those directions for you to dive into. So Just strategies. And then the last third, and actually sometimes less than that, is actually playing. And in the actual playing, there are almost countless timeouts. You know, like you go to the Knicks and every few minutes they call out timeout. Why? Because the coach wants to discuss what just happened. Today it's much more sophisticated because with the technology of video playback, a coach can get to show the athlete, the soccer player, immediate response of the exact angle, or maybe from several angles, how he played that kick, that throw. And all this in preparation for the final game. I want to ask you, what is the purpose of taking an examination?
To test our skills.
So the examiner will look at the examination paper, and based on our answers, if they are correct answers, that will demonstrate knowledge or skill in the area we're being tested on. I never forget when I was taking my master's degree in education, there was one course there where the professor announced on the first day of that course, 70% of your grade is based on class participation. And I was thrilled. But what was very interesting is that the first 2 weeks, there was quite a lot of class participation. And as the weeks continued, it began to peter off. And not because I think there was a conscious act to not be involved in the dialogue or to share one's position or opinions or give feedback. It was simply that we were forgetting that we were being tested and that we had the opportunity in every moment of thinking carefully through what we're listening to and analyze, critically consider, do I agree, disagree, why? And so I want to suggest that the type of examination that we're talking about when we describe this world, Olam Hazeh, as Olam HaNisayon, the world of a test. It's one big test. That the test is not just preparation for 120 years old when we arrive and we see the final score and there's a playback of every single maneuver, every single conversation that we ever had from the moment we were born till we passed on, but rather an understanding that it's not just the score at the end, but we were being tested all along. And that God is our coach. But he wants to take a sideline. He doesn't want to participate openly, because in doing so, if we were on the receiving end of open miracles on a daily basis, which would be so obvious to us that God is right there, smacking us in the face when we make a mistake, and encouraging us, slapping us on the back when we're doing well, if we really saw God on the sidelines cheering us, we would lose our free will, and therefore the test could not maximize the opportunity of the reward. And the reward is not just after 120 years. Because I'll ask you, what do you think is the greater reward? Getting the grade A or becoming proficient in that subject? Because even if I fail because the examiner doesn't see that I really know it, let's say, for example, you had a bad day. You really had, and your mind went blank, but you know, and for whatever reason, you failed the exam. Does that mean everything was wasted? I can always do a retake, but even if I don't get that exam, is it possible that the information I have will still be useful in other applications? And what happens if, God forbid, we enter a marriage and it doesn't work? We get divorced. Does that mean that the marriage was a failure? Or is there another dimension? That all the encounters that we had, all the differences that we tried to work out, became opportunities or a learning experience that taught me what I can and cannot handle, what my limitations are, what my strengths are, what areas I'm weak on, what areas I'm strong on. And therefore, as much as I might want to discard myself as a failure because the marriage did not work, but wait a minute, what am I carrying with me after these 5, 10 or 15, whatever years of marriage, in terms of skills, memories, strengths and weaknesses, that I can now say this is the clarity I have for the next relationship. Codependent no more. So in a sense, failure is giving up. It's not really the result. Failure is despairing of personal growth. God is not interested in us failing. God is not out to fail us. And any mistakes that we make along the way are part of the course, in the sense that when do we learn the most from our victories or from our mistakes? When we look back in our lives at the most painful moments, whether it was a relationship or whether it was a financial setback or a medical setback, and then ask ourselves, having identified the most painful moment that we had, what memory comes to the front of your mind when you ask, when did I have the most clarity in finances? When did I get the most clarity in relationships? When did I feel at last I've really advanced in my maturity in how to handle children? And ask ourselves, is there any correlation between the mistake and the clarity? Excuse me. I think we'll notice that the more painful the relationship, the capacity, the magnitude of the lesson is still greater. The more painful the financial setback, the stronger we have the chance to learn, wow, $250,000? Now that's called enough pain to get me thinking, what can I possibly learn to make it worthwhile? Or I could get depressed for a long time, psychoanalyze how I got into it in the first place, and then beat myself up for having made such a foolish mistake. I have the choice of moving forward or replaying the past and living there, or saying, wait a minute, what can I take from what I've been through that will make me smarter on the next deal? Is it possible that the shrewdest businessmen have made serious blunders and yet will admit that their biggest windfalls, their best deals came because of the clarity they now had, which they possibly would not have had at that level did they not go through that mistake, that failure, that blunder, that blind spot? I see one businessman who's quite successful at the back nodding his head with absolute conviction to that statement. Is it possible that the mistakes we've made on our first child becomes the guinea pig, not deliberately so, but by default, becomes the practice and training for raising the other kids? Is it possible that the mistakes I make in the first 10 years with my children is really a 10-year trial in parenting, so that the rest of my relationship will be based on the lessons I've learned? And in a sense, our children have very little memory of the first years of childhood, and that's a gift from God. Because the memories are there, but it's very hard to bring them to the fore. We have an opportunity that in the first few years we can make mistakes and to a certain extent afford it, because the stakes are low. When you're making mistakes with small monies, small investments, it's the best time to learn how to invest prudently, carefully, cautiously. When we make mistakes in the first year of marriage, it's called Shana Rishona. In Judaism, we actually have, I think it's in chapter 21 of Deuteronomy, there's one of the 613 instructions, less known, that a husband is forbidden to go into the army. He's not allowed to take upon public duties for the community in the first year of marriage, because he needs to devote himself single-focusedly to his wife, because the first year is laying the foundation. And Shana Rishona, the first year, our rabbis nowadays tell us, lasts about 15 years. Because it takes such a long time to get it right, to get used to each other. And that first year is pivotal. It's so crucial, because when children are born, our focus gets split into other areas, the need to earn a living is intensified. To move into a larger apartment home, to change address in order to be part of a community, to raise our child according to the values we espouse to, that the first year is so crucial to spend a lot of time together. The mistakes we make in the first year are the best mistakes we'll ever make. The first mistakes we make in any area of our lives are the best, because they tell us who we are. They tell us our strengths, they tell us our weaknesses. And this brings us to a new understanding of what is the purpose of a test. Why does God call this world Olam HaNisayon, the world of the test? It's one long test. And the reason is because, think for a moment, when the coach elevates the high jump, the bar for the high jump, one more millimeter, do we know whether or not the athlete can make the jump? We're not sure. But the reason we're doing it is because we have confidence that with the motivation and stamina, the training and the self-confidence, the will to win, he can and possibly will make that jump. But if God is our life coach, our spiritual life coach, does he already know or not whether we're going to make the jump? Of course he knows already. So when God tests us, it's not to demonstrate to him our strength, because he already knows. So obviously, it's for us to notice ourselves, how strong we can be. Because once we make that jump, what will it do to our psyche? What will it do to our nervous system? What will it do to our mindset and our level of self-estimation? Will it hold us to a lower level, a lower standard of expectations, or a higher standard? Now that I know I can make that jump, now that I have experienced once controlling my anger amidst a firing squad of insults from my children or my spouse, and instead of firing back other bullets that I have in my arsenal, I decided to listen and then talk gently about it afterwards. And that one time that we conquered anger, does that hold us to a lower level in controlling emotions or higher? Every time we get our kid off to school in the morning and it's, I can't believe it's 8:45, you're still not dressed, you haven't got your sneakers on, your backpack, where is your snack for school? You haven't finished homework? You missed your bus again. My life doesn't begin till 9 a.m. Now, I know there's no one here who relates to any of this, but some of you have friends who know what I'm talking about. When we turn ourselves around and say, darling, let me give you a hand getting dressed. Let's find your socks together. And until our 5-6-year-old gets into the training of figuring it out themselves, where the breakfast bowl for cereal is, how to put it away in the milky dishwasher, not the meaty one. Once we train them in to snacking bag before you go to bed at night, clothes laid out by your bed before you go to sleep, in the training is the preparation for success. And that when we taste the success of training our children, we hold ourselves to a higher standard. And then the old standard is no longer acceptable to us. And we can move forward. So the purpose of the test is not from God's position to find out, does this Jew have it in him? Does she have the ability to just remind her husband in a gentle way without any other reminders and let him figure out on his own that if he's late for that appointment or he forgets to pick up his own suit from the dryer, dry clean, he will learn the consequences all by himself. The question is, when God is testing us, it's all about not, why are you doing this to me, God? It's about noticing me, seeing my strength and my weaknesses. The Jewish people have been compared to an olive. Why? Because what happens when you squeeze an olive? You get the juice. What determines the quality of the olive oil that comes out when you squeeze an olive? First time you press the olive, you're going to get the highest quality drops. The first few drops are the best quality. And what else determines the quality of those drops?
Which olive you're pressing.
The quality of the olive. So now, when a person is squeezed, what comes out? Depends how ripe they are inside. If I'm a parent and I'm a first timer, what's going to come out when I'm squeezed with the kids nagging and screaming and defiance? And the answer is an immature response. If we've had very good training from our parents, hey, we might be pretty well trained before we get into the arena of parenting ourselves. If we had good role models, or we spent a lot of times with couples who are really very good with each other, and even when, not if they get into conflict, even when they get into conflict, they're very respectful about how they make shalom or heal, and we learn from that. That it's possible to be different and still live together? Wow. In fact, the very word shalom in Hebrew, we are told, Rav Nachman of Breslov goes to town on this one a lot, he explains the word shalom is the fusing of opposite forces. Shalom is not a term that is accurately applied to friends, because friends are attracted by similarities. But shalom is applied to opposing forces. Husband, wife, parent, child, child, parent-in-law, boss, client, boss, employee, where you've got different people with different agendas, that is where the word shalom more accurately applies. So what we're talking about over here is when we squeeze the olive, when we squeeze a person, what's going to come out is how well trained the person is in the particular area they're now being squeezed in. If it's financial prowess, if it's spousing, being married, if it's raising children, getting along with a difficult parent-in-law, difficult parent, it will all depend on the training, the quality of the training, the coach we've had, the self-confidence that's built upon successes, the stamina, which may come from many different places of what we saw in our parents, or what we've decided in our own lives of how much we're willing to put up with. But if God is the coach, that means He has very meticulously selected the exact person who needs to enter my life to bring out the differences, the strengths and the weaknesses that I need to deal with. And therefore He chooses the parents, even the spouse, even the children. You know how many times parents are amazed? How is it that my 6-year-old daughter is a doll? She just listens to everything. I never have to remind her to do homework. It's the first thing she does when she comes home. And my 7-year-old son, he is such a schlump. You can't believe it. The moment he comes home, his sleeves are halfway out of his coat and his coat is lying on the floor. I have to drag him to the desk to do his homework, just a silly little spelling and reading. Everything is a big effort. And then the same children, same home, totally different. And God knows that I have more than one weakness. And more than one strength. And the only way I'm going to fine-tune and develop and grow is if I'm forced to. And therefore, without an Olympic coach training me, I ain't gonna do well in the final exam. I'm not going to get a gold medal. So God says, I know that I created man with a deliberate resistance to change, to growth. And so I invented 3 arenas for practicing training on a daily basis to get an Olympic medal in patience, love, affection, giving, kindliness, sensitivity, happiness, love, gratitude, apology. God says the training is 3 areas. I invented marriage, I invented children, and I invented going to work. going to work, earning a living. These are the three places that we are tested consistently and constantly on a daily basis: relationships and money. The only failure is despair. The only failure is giving up. And that's not failure until the end of our days. Because what happens if 5 years later I wake up from my depression and turn myself around and maybe even use what I've learned to tell other people who've been depressed for 2 or 3 years, and I say, you know what? I was depressed for five. I spent 5 years in bed, eating, watching TV, taking drugs, control drugs, to get out of my depression. And finally I made a choice to get out of it. Finally it worked. I turned myself around. And slowly, I picked myself up, fell down again, picked myself up, fell down again, up, down, until I became consistently strong in my inner stamina to look at what's good in my life. I consistently remained strong to not touch alcohol. I consistently remained strong to stop smoking. But until then, hey, it's easy to give up cigarettes. I've done it thousands of times. The best and most successful businessmen fail the most times in business, according to Harvard report, on multimillionaires. 96% of them fail the most times in business, which means they didn't give up until they succeeded. It's not the losses and it's not the apparent failures that equal how strong I am, how many relationships I've been through, how much I messed up with my kid. The bottom line is who I've decided to make out of myself because of what I went through. And here I want to introduce you to Abraham, our patriarch. Because he was tested 10 times by God. What was the genesis of this test? And I'm going to speak just esoterically for a few moments in order to get the full picture of creation and understanding the full movie of history when we see where Abraham arrived on the scene. Adam was supposed to withstand one test: don't eat from the tree. Had he withstood that test, the Sabbath, which he was created only a few hours prior to, would have heralded in the Messiah, the Messianic period, in which God would have created a situation that man lives forever and would be constantly aware of his divine coach. But in that awareness, there would be no choice to do anything bad, because it would be so clear to us how bad it is to hurt someone with our words that we would be incapable of hurting them. You know what it's like? You love your daughter so much that even if she does something wrong, you would have to pretend to be angry or pretend to be outraged or pretend to say a sharp word because you love that person so much. You respect that person so much. Comes along God and says, Adam, you messed up, and now I'm going to have to wait for an individual who will climb the ladder of personal growth, conquering themselves, conquering their anger, the negative emotions of jealousy, of hatred, of arrogance, nurturing humility, understanding, interpreting other people's negative behavior in a kind light and giving them a second chance, a third chance, a fourth chance, being loving to your spouse even when you're very different, finding a deep love to connect with your child when they're defiant. Abraham, you were the one that I chose. But I didn't choose you as much as you chose me. Because I put you through 10 trials until you passed all of them with flying colors. And there were many people with greater intellect than even Abraham. But the reason why he became the column, the one that is the starting point of the Jewish nation, that became a selected people, Am HaNivcha, chosen people, was because from Adam till Abraham, no one else succeeded in using their mind to fathom the purpose of creation as much as Abraham did. Let's look at the nature of his tests, and it will reveal to us what it means to live in a world which is one long test. It's not called Olam HaNisyonot, the world of tests. It's Olam HaNisayon, the world of the test. It's one long examination. And the grade is not based on the result as much as it's based on participation in class. Those 120 years. Every moment counts. You go to a Knicks game. I only went to one. I had to take a student to a Knicks game once. It was amazing. I couldn't believe the lessons that were saturated in this game. Every few minutes, timeout. The coach wanted to analyze where they were going, the mistakes that were being made, how to change around the direction of the game. And you could have a timeout in such a way that in the last 3 seconds of the game, if it's really intense and the score is really balanced, you call timeout and for 2 minutes discuss what we're going to do in the last 3 seconds. Every moment counts, because until the last moment, the whole result can be totally different. That's why in Jewish law, if you see a Jew, non-Jew as well, but I bring it out for ourselves to understand the preciousness of life and time. If you see a Jew who's dying, and it's the Sabbath, and you're 100% sure he's only got, let's say, 30 seconds to live, are you permitted to, let's say, remove rubble that has fallen on top of him in order that they'll be able to learn 30 seconds, live another 30 seconds? But that's a violation of the Sabbath. Are you allowed to break every law of the Sabbath to save a person's life for 20 seconds, 10 seconds? And the answer is yes. If you could scientifically know that he's only going to live another 10 seconds, you're allowed to break every one of the 39 violations of the Sabbath, including all their thousands of details, for a person to live for a few seconds. And the answer, the reason why, even if you know they'd be in a coma, and the reason why is because every second counts. That in the mind of a person, they could forgive everyone who's ever hurt them, and in that moment of forgiveness, clean the slate of all the relationships that are in debt to him. In a moment of change, they could say, I bitterly regret everything I ever did to hurt another person. And even though it won't be the success of apologizing directly with that person, it will be a major accomplishment on the scorecard 10 seconds from now when the game is over. So every moment counts. Let's look briefly at Abraham and see what is in the power of being tested. Because here is the first human being since Adam. And think for a moment. Adam was not born from parents. He had an amazing advantage over us. He has no invisible loyalties to the mistakes of his parents, because he was created from God. He was FFC, from creation. But we have the challenge of changing ourselves. Abraham was the first one. And what was his first test? Amazing! The first test in chapter 12 of Genesis goes like this. Abraham, lech lecha! Go! I'll say the words exactly. Chapter 12, verse 1. Vayom Hashem el Avram. God spoke to Abraham. This is the first time God speaks to Abraham. He's 75 years old, and we're told that he recognized God at the tender age of 4. So he's been working with a lot of stamina and self-confidence that there really is one God who hasn't yet communicated with him. And now he reached the point where God speaks to him. And what's the message? Lech lecha! Go! Me'artzecha! From your land. Umi moladetecha! From the place you were born. Umi beit avicha! From the house of your parents, your father. El ha'aretz! To the land. Asher ereka! That I'm going to show you. What was the test? Leave your home, your community, your environment, your culture, everything you're used to, and go to the land, which I'm not even telling you where it is, I'm going to show you. Now think for a moment. Till now, what do we know about Abraham? He was a renegade, a rebel. He was the one person against everyone in known civilization at that time who said, you're all wrong. There's one God. There aren't idols that represent power. There's only one invisible being that is the all-powerful source of all other powers. And when his father saw that his son smashed up all the idols, you remember the story, his father betrayed him, gave him in to King Nimrod, who attempted to assassinate him by having him put in a furnace because he refused to agree that King Nimrod was a human being, divine incarnate. He refused to accept Nimrod as a divine being. So Abraham was betrayed by his father. What is betrayal on a level of a scale of 0 to 10 in terms of a negative experience? Betrayal of a parent? Whoa! He was put into a dungeon for 10 years for refusing to accept Nimrod, the king, and after 10 years, he came out, and Nimrod said, Abraham, what lesson have you learned in the last 10 years? Who am I? Am I the almighty king of the universe? And Abraham said, dear Nimrod, you know what? I would love to believe that you really are, so could you please make the sun rise in the west instead of the east? Could you please make the rain fall right now in the cloudless sky? This is too much humiliation. So Nimrod had him thrown into a furnace to show that I am the God of fire. Let's see how you stand up to my power. And Abraham survived. He comes out, and God says, Abraham, leave your home, leave your environment. What type of a test is that? He's hated by his home, he's hated by his society, he's the only one who says there's one God. There's no test. You hear the problem? This was supposed to be the first of 10 tests. 10 trials. Tells us the Sfat Emet, one of our great luminaries of the Hasidic world, every trial has in it a clue to tell us what we have to overcome. Look at the words. Lech, lecha. Strange language. Go, lech, go, lecha, to yourself. Go into yourself and then leave your homeland, your parents' home, the place of your birth. I want you to leave with not the slightest vestige, not the slightest taint of environmental influence. I want you to leave your home with zero loyalties to your parents' behavior unless you've deliberately chosen in your mind that that is a correct way to live. In other words, I don't want you to be a product of anything that is outside of you. Anything you've decided to do, the way you dress, the way you speak, the way you eat, what you eat, how you talk to your spouse, how you relate to your children, I want that to be a conscious choice on your part and not a subconscious playoff, spin-off result from how your mom and dad responded, how your environment dictates values, describes reality. I want you to leave. I want you to go into yourself, become so aware of everything you say and do and think that when you leave your home and your environment, the place of your birth, it's you, totally independent. We are called Ba'alei Bechira, which translates correctly as masters, owners of choice. We get to choose how to turn ourselves around, no matter what our past was. No matter how difficult our parenting, or how difficult it was with that job, we have the power of choice to turn ourselves around. So Lech Lecha was the test of going into himself, becoming aware of himself, and leaving his home environment. Judging his wife, talking to his wife, not because that's how his dad spoke to his mum. No, it was a conscious choice to speak to his wife because that's the right way to speak to her. Let's look at the 10th trial of Abraham, because the parallels are phenomenal. Lech Lecha, we said, was a special language which is the hidden clue of what the test was about, what the trial was about. It was about going into himself, because there was no trial to leave his land. Who hated him, resented him, he put them into a position of having to defend themselves. Abraham is told one more time, Lech Lecha. And it's the only time in the Bible, in the entire Torah, that we find the words Lech Lecha repeated. And that is at the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. Now think for a moment. The greatest, most powerful trial that God could give his athlete. What would be the greatest trial a coach could give his athlete? And that is the trial of, everything I've taught you, I now want you to do totally different. Without thinking, even for a moment, that my credibility is any the less. Because by now, I have such a track record with you, that you trust me, that everything I've ever done in training for the Olympics, to get a gold medal in righteous conduct, in getting a gold medal in the high jump, every strategy I ever taught you, you saw, was so carefully calculated that after a while you stopped asking me why and accepted with total trust in the process. Not blind faith, no. Faith based on a track record of trust that I came through each time. Now I'm going to ask you, is your level of trust in me as your coach 100% that if I tell you that everything I told you is now going to be the 180 degrees turned around in my last request of how to win the last strategy, are you going to be able to stand up to it without even thinking that there's something wrong with the coach? Abraham, you've been preaching your entire life. God is one God. A God of mercy, a God of kindliness. That's why I've been practicing having guests in my home. That was Abraham and Sarah's strategy of Kiruv. No professional Kiruv. No. Invite someone in your home. Feed them. And talk about where this food came from. Who's the source of our blessing. Abraham, you've been telling everyone, don't prove your allegiance to the idol in the ultimate sacrifice of your child? God is a God of kindliness. He wants you to love your children. He gave you children to continue humanity, not to sacrifice. Abraham, I want you, Lech Lecha! I want you to go and sacrifice. Bring as an offering your only child, the son you love, the one that I promised to you in chapter 15, that is going to be the founder of an entire nation. The one I promised to you when you said, my wife is barren, I'm nearly 100 years old, my wife is nearly 90, and we have no children. And God, you're promising me that I'm going to look outside, you say in chapter 15, and count the stars. That's how many children you're going to have. God, I'm barren. Perhaps at least let the blessing be fulfilled in my son Yishmael, who I gave birth to through Hagar, my handmaid, my maidservant. God said, no. I'm going to give you a son, and his name's going to be Isaac, and through him will be your nation. And now, Abraham is told, take Isaac, who's 37 years old, and offer him up as an offering. And look at the wording. Vayhi achar hadvarim ha'ele, after these things, chapter 22, verse 1. Vaha Elokim, the all-powerful, Nisa et Avraham, tested Abraham, Nisayon. We're going to look at that word in a few moments. Vayom elav, and he said, Avraham, Vayom elav Avraham, Vayom ineni, and Abraham replied, here I am. Behold, here I am. Whatever you want, tell me. I'm at your command. I trust you implicitly. You've been my coach and successful coach till now. Whatever you're going to tell me, just tell me. Vayomer, and he said, Kach na et bincha, take your son, et yichidcha, your only son from Sarah, she ahavta, that you love, et Yitzhak, Isaac, the Lech Lecha, the only other time in the Torah that Lech Lecha appears. And here's the clue of what this test is about. Lechla el Eretz HaMoria, take him to the land of Moria, the mountain of Moria, ve'aleu sham, and bring him up there, le'ola, as a burnt offering. What are the parallels? Look at these three parallels, they are amazing. What's the difference between the first test of Abraham and the last one? Lech Lecha is his first test, first trial. And Lech Lecha, go sacrifice your son, is the last one. The first one, Abraham is being told, you know what? Give up your past! Don't tell me I was going to say that. All these microphones all over my... These are tie clips, right? Give up your past. Let go of anything negative in the parenting that you received from mom and dad. Anything that you... These are tie clips, right? Give up your past. Let go of anything negative in the parenting that you received from mom and dad. Anything that you've been tainted from in your values, your decision-making process, your thought-making process, let go. Become so aware of your thoughts, your speech, and your actions that you are consciously aware of everything you say and do and think. Let go of your past. The last test says, let go of your future. The child I promised you, the nation I promised you, all those 10 tests I've given you till now, let go of it all. Sacrifice your son. Face the world, how are you going to tell them, God told me to sacrifice my son when I told you that's not what God wants? Wow. Did Abraham negotiate? Was he capable of negotiating? Absolutely. Chapter 18, when God said, I'm going to destroy Sodom, somehow Abraham wasn't silent. Sodom, but God, what happens if there's righteous individuals there? How could you destroy all those wicked people? You might be destroying... He was perfectly capable of answering back. But he understood God meant it. Take your son. He was silent. In the first Lech Lecha, in the first time he's told, leave your land, what was the response of Abraham? Vayelech Avraham, and Abraham went, Kasher Diber Hashem, as God spoke to him. Total obedience. What was his response to the second Lech Lecha? To the second time he was told, go. Vayashkem Avraham baboker. Abraham got up early in the morning. When God said, take your son Isaac, he woke up before dawn. He saddled the donkey. He was dressed and ready. Vayashkem is the language of zirizut. Passion, excitement. Moving, zaz means move. He was moved to immediate action. He didn't hesitate for a moment to do what God told him to do. And we know, of course, the end of it was, God said, I was only joking. It's not for real. So, okay, but now I know that you have the strength to listen to me no matter what. And that power, that stamina of never giving up, that I will remain loyal to you, my Creator, no matter what, that power is now in your DNA, your spiritual DNA. Your soul has now encoded the success of those 10 trials. When an athlete has been practicing thousands and thousands of times that throw, guess what? In the final game, when he makes that throw, his whole body and mind has been wired up. That in that moment, even if it's an away game, and all the crowd are booing, he's got total focus in the moment that he's going to make that throw the same way he did it thousands of times successfully. Abraham, you have succeeded in these 10 trials that I am planting in the seed of your descendants, the same spiritual DNA, that they have the spiritual power to withstand any level of persecution, no matter how much the nations squeeze you. No matter how much you're squeezed, the quality of the oil that comes out of the olive is going to be pure. and you're going to stand up to everything until you reach the end of the movie, the end of time, the final exam. The score will be in front of everyone, and I will reveal how every single effort of every Jew counted to the final destiny of the Jewish people. And it all started with this trial. What we see here is the following: that God hides in the obstacle itself. When God says, Lech Lecha, he's saying, go into yourself, Abraham. And when you sacrifice your child, I'm telling you, go into yourself. You have inside you the inner strength to withstand what I'm telling you to do. When you find yourself part of a family that is driving you meshuggah, totally crazy, I'm telling you, Lech Lecha means go into yourself. I gave you the strength to learn how to take the good and how to let go of the bad. So that when you build your family, don't do it with fear that you're going to transplant, transfer, transmit the same negative stuff. Because Baalei Bechira, we created creatures of choice, masters of choice. We can change our emotions by choice. We can change how we invest, how we save, how we spend less than we earn, instead of spending more than we earn. We can change anything we want by the power of free will. Lech Lecha means the strength is already in us. If we are sent a difficult child, we can get through it. It's a training. If we're sent a difficult father-in-law, mother-in-law, difficult boss, a difficult client, a difficult co-worker, a different landlady, landlord, I think we covered everybody. Inside of us, Lech Lecha means don't run away. Go forward and take the strength from within yourself. You have what it takes to get beyond and be strong no matter what you've been through. And this brings us to a very important understanding of what Nisayon means, of what that object is. So when we look at Nisayon, the word test in Hebrew, the letters combined should relate to us. What is the reality of a test? What are the ingredients of the test? What is the purpose of a test? Nisayon has in it the word Nes. Nes means flag. When you hold up a flag, what is a flag? It's a sign. It's a statement, identity of direction, where I'm going, who I am. A flag is a sign of identity, and it's also a direction to help me know where to go. Inside the test is a route, a map that tells me, if I'm being tested with anger, again and again and again, and I say, God, please, 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 give me patience with this woman. Give me patience with my husband. Give me patience with this child. This boss is driving me crazy. Give me patience. And a few seconds later, after you finished your request, who walks in? And who presses the buttons that gets you right under your skin? God, what did I just say? Give me patience. And now look at you sending me. And God looks down and says, you idiot, Rieti. You ask me for patience. There's only one way you're ever going to get it. And that is training, practice. You want patience? Here's another exercise. Who do you want patience with? Oh, let me send him right in. You want patience with your kid? Here he comes. When we are being tried and tested on a daily basis, inside us is the strength. And inside the test is the flag that sends us in the direction. You want to strengthen yourself in patience. You want to strengthen yourself in listening. Oh boy. You want to listen more carefully to your spouse, to your children, to the intent behind your boss's instructions so you just don't get it technically correct but understand what he really meant. Then I'm going to send it to you, but inside the test is the flag that reads on it what direction to go in. It's not me trying to fail you. I'm not lifting up the high jump so you're eventually going to fail. I'm here to show you where you're holding. Because guess what's going to come out when I squeeze you? What's ever inside. And what's ever inside that comes out is for me to see this is who I am right now. And that will be a flag. That's a signpost to tell me where I've got to go next. I might not be ready to jump into total patience because I haven't learned to listen properly yet. Inside the word Nisayon is Nisa, which we said in chapter 22 was the language used when Abraham was tested by God. V'Elokim Nisa, Nun Samach Hey, tested Abraham. Nisa means elevate. Nisa means to elevate. The purpose of a test is to get me to make the high jump a little bit, another millimeter. Is to get me a little bit stronger in patience, a little bit stronger in listening, and with more exercises from the spouse, the children, and the workplace, the three places we said we get tested the most, because we need a coach, and we're not going to employ one on our own. We can't take our therapist wherever we go. So God says, I'll be your ultimate therapist, 1-800-ALMIGHTY. I'll be your ultimate therapist. Listen to me, talk to me, notice me in the test, and you're going to see that in the test is not only the signpost of where to go next, because the signpost is not going to tell you right to the end result of your destiny. No, it's going to tell you to the next point on the journey, and there's going to be a sign for the next point until you arrive. But Nes also means Nisa. I'm going to lift you up as you go along, because even if I fall along the way, I'm getting stronger. I'm learning the route. I'm going to remember I've been down here before and it didn't work when I struck out at you, when I used those sharp words, when I threw at you my list of your crimes against me. It didn't work. When I scream at my child, when I lecture to him somehow or other, it just doesn't work. When I intimidate my employee, it just doesn't work. It may look like it does, but it really doesn't long term. Says God, it's here to elevate me. And the last meaning in the word Nisayon is Nes. Miracle. Because greater than splitting the sea, greater than the creation of the universe, greater than any miracle God does to interfere with the natural laws of nature that He programmed world to exist upon, greater than God interfering with nature and us being wowed that God must be there, it's a miracle. The greatest miracle of all is man changing his nature. My husband turning around, my wife turning around, my child taking responsibility, my boss noticing and appreciating how much I bust my tail for the last 17 years without a raise. The greatest, most powerful and impressive miracle of all is when we change ourselves, when we change what comes out our mouth. When we change what goes in our mouth, when we change what goes in our minds, what we listen to, what we read, what we won't watch on TV, on video, internet, that is a miracle. That we change ourselves by freeing ourselves of where we come from and decide where we're going to. We free ourselves of what we put into our mouths and we control what goes in. And controlling our lives is ultimate freedom. Controlling where we choose to go is real freedom, and not being controlled by who told me to dress this way, live this way, talk this way. I never forget friends I used to have. I think I may have mentioned this another night, that when I used to meet friends in class reunions who'd gone to Oxford or Cambridge, and sometimes only a matter of a few months or a year or two since I last saw them, and they're speaking, oh yes, oh how terribly good to see you again, oh wonderful, oh yes, oh wonderful. I say, that's terribly interesting. Yeah, yes. They didn't speak like this before. In fact, you know, when they would stand, they would hold a cup of coffee in a special area. What's going on? Well, if you visit Oxford and Cambridge, you suddenly realize, oh my gosh, you saturate yourself amongst people who talk and walk this way. You walk out talking this way. God says the greatest miracle of all is to go inside and leave consciously deciding who I am, what I put in, what I put out, how I communicate, how I don't communicate, is the real miracle. No carbon copies. No, the miracle is I change myself by controlling my emotion of jealousy, hatred, revenge. These are serious violations. The Torah tells me I am accountable to changing in my life. Not to answer back with sharp words, but to respond with silence from strength, not from weakness. This is changing myself. This is the purpose of a test. I'll just finish off quickly. When we look at our history, any personality you want to pull out and put on video and watch what they went through, you see the pattern is the same. They became great not because they had the most wonderful parents, the most supportive environment, the most incredible job opportunity. Sarah, the wife of Abraham, barren 90 years, kidnapped twice, went through a famine with her husband. When her husband was thrown into the furnace, do you think she was saying, "Hey, Abe, good luck, I'll be baking pizzas in the oven over here"? No, she went through the same trial that Abraham went through. Sarah didn't become who she became despite what she went through. She became great because of what she went through. Moses was raised in the palace of Pharaoh. From the tender age of a few days old, surrounded by royalty, and had no superiority complex. He cared about his people, his suffering brothers and sisters. His sensitivity was not the less for it. Rivka, Rebecca, our matriarch, her father was Betuel, one of the sickest men in history. Betuel was not his real name. It's a play on words. Betula, forgive me, you're a mature audience. Betula means virgin. He was called Betuel because he was a governor of many lands and he had legislation. Any bride who gets married has to visit him the night before her wedding. That's the sickness of this man. And he fathered Rebecca. Rebecca was born to such a sick personality. And who was her brother? J.R. Lavan. Did you ever see who killed J.R.? Dallas, right? I know you didn't see it. No one saw it because it was on Friday nights. Anyway. Who killed J.R.? J.R. Larry Hagman. He was the worst scoundrel, liar, con man, in and out of affairs. Totally untrustworthy. Lavan makes J.R. look like a poo bear. Lavan was the worst trickster and con man in history, and he was the brother of Rivka. And we are told, who was Rivka? In chapter 25 of Genesis, who was Rivka? We already know from chapter 24 when she got to Shidduch, she was matched off with Isaac. We already know who her father was, the country she came from, and who her brother was. But listen to the words the Torah gives away who she became. What are the words? Says the Torah, chapter 25, verse 20. And Yitzhak was 40 years old when he took Rivka, the daughter of Betuel, Ha'arami, from Padan Aram, the sister of Lavan, Ha'arami, as a wife. So Rashi says straight away, wait a minute, this is chapter 25. Chapter 24, we already told who Rivka is. We know where she's from, who her father is and who her brother is. Why does the Torah waste ink over here? The Torah was written at the dictate of the Creator. Never a drop is wasted. If it's repeated here, it's for a reason. Says Rashi, Lehagid Shvacha, to tell her praise. The praise of Rivka is, don't I already know that she was the daughter of Betuel, the sister of Lavan, from Padan Aram? Ela lahagid shvacha, to tell her praise, shehaita bat rasha, she was the daughter of a wicked man. The ahot rasha, her brother, her siblings, wicked. Umekoma, and the place she came from, anshe rasha, they were people who were wicked. She came from the worst environment, promiscuity, the lowest values. And here's the key words. V'lolamda m'ma'aseihem. She didn't learn from their actions. She retrained her mindset. She retrained her values. She let go and moved forward in a direction that she chose. Whoever you pull out, Rachel and Leah, the daughters of Lavan, the wives of Jacob, whoever you pull out, you will find in history became great, not because of what they went through. sorry, not despite what they went through, but because of what they went through. And the asylum that we suffer in a marriage or a second marriage, with our children, with our careers, with lost aspirations, the feeling of I'm just not going to make it. All these tests are one long test, and each one of it has inside God saying to me, there's a miracle here. That's my choice to turn myself around. I elevate myself when I improve just a millimeter at a time. And every test has in it the signpost of how to move forward. Thank you for your patience.